2 days ago, Randy Dunn resigned from the Missouri House. So now, he can tell us what he really thinks about the way things work in Jeff City.
For some people, they get a little taste of power, if you will, and they want to hold on to that at whatever cost. And even if that's at the detriment to the people they were sent there to represent.
Former Representative Randy Dunn, today on Statehouse Blend, Missouri. From KCUR Studios, this is Statehouse Blend, Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. It's been a quiet week in Jefferson City. The House and Senate went through the formality of wrapping up the special session called by Governor Eric Greitens to create a financial incentive to bring several hundred jobs to the Missouri Boot Heel. This after one of the most rancorous and least productive regular sessions that most lawmakers can remember. Now, the rumor is that Governor Greitens has another session on the way. No announcement officially as we tape this on a Saturday, but sources have told KCUR and other media outlets that it's commonly understood around the Statehouse that sometime in mid-June, they'll be called back to talk about abortion. If that happens, one legislator who won't be around for it is Representative Randy Dunn, who's resigned from the House to take a new job in Omaha. The Kansas City Democrat agreed to stop by our KCUR studios for some coffee and donuts and an exit interview. And Randy, it's great to have you on Statehouse Blend.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Really,
glad to be here.
Really glad to see you. And you've lived your whole life in Kansas City, right?
I have. Born and raised here in Kansas City. It's been home for the last 34 years for me.
Wow. And so this is a big deal that you would take a new job in Omaha, right?
It is, yeah. It's not something I expected, but it was a great opportunity that came my way. And it was just one of those opportunities I couldn't pass up on.
Well, we will definitely talk about that. But let's talk about your time in the Missouri General Assembly first. You served 2.5 terms. You were elected this past year to your third term, so that means you went down there for 5 regular sessions. Just generally speaking, what was that time like for you?
This has been, the last 5 years, the most rewarding but also the most frustrating 5 years of my life. A lot of the issues that were important to me and to the constituents that I served were not priorities of the majority party. And so that made it very frustrating to go down there fighting and advocating on behalf of the folks I was sent there to represent, knowing that most likely the issues that are most important to them and to me were not a priority to the majority.
And so what issues are we talking about?
Healthcare, Medicaid expansion. Every year we pushed and fought for Medicaid expansion, not only because it was, in my opinion, the morally right thing to do, but economically it made a lot of sense for us to do that. But that never happened. Voter ID, again, something that for a lot of the folks that I represented was likely going to disenfranchise many of them because they didn't have the proper ID that would now be necessary based upon our new law to cast their ballot. And so those are certainly some of the issues that were of importance to me, as well as MONA, the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act. It's a bill that I had filed for the last 5 years that I'd been in the legislature, and that never got across the finish line.
It's been filed 19 years in a row, I read.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why do you think that is? I mean, you said those three big issues, healthcare and the Non-Discrimination Act and voter ID, important to you, important to your constituents, never really had a chance with the Republican majority in the House. How come?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One, to be very frank, I think because for some of those issues, they did not have big paid lobbyists that were pushing those issues that were putting funds into the coffers of the majority party. So I certainly think that that was a part of it. I think the majority party, they have just become socially more conservative over the last several years. And these were sort of like third rail issues for them that they just did not want to touch. Even though when I would have one-on-one conversations with a lot of my colleagues, they would tell me, oh, I really believe in that. I support that. However, if I were to vote for that, I may get a primary opponent. And that was really disheartening for me to hear that sort of talk from my colleagues, you know, them recognizing and understanding the true issues at heart, but they were more concerned about getting reelected than doing what was right for the people.
And is that and you're not the first legislator I've heard say that about folks voting sort of against their conscience, but for their their political prospects. Do you, is that a flaw of character? Are we electing morally weak people to the General Assembly, or is this just the reality of the world and we should get used to it?
I would hate to think that that's the reality and that's something we just have to get used to. I think, unfortunately, for some people, they get a little taste of power, if you will, and they want to hold on to that at whatever cost, and even if that's at the detriment to the people they were sent there to represent. And so I think as an electorate, we do have to be much more cognizant of who we are sending down there to represent us and holding them accountable to do the things that we know are right. And if we see them making decisions that are in their best interest as opposed to the best interest of the people, we need to call them out on that.
Of course, one of the realities is that most of the districts in the House in particular, where you served, are very partisan. They are extremely Democratic districts or extremely Republican districts. Some years, maybe every year, you didn't even have a Republican primary or Republican opponent, right?
Correct.
So you've never even faced one. It's unlikely that people are going to move to the middle or become more conciliatory or vote their conscience when their districts are so partisan, is it?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the flaws in terms of the way our legislative maps are drawn. I think if we had more districts that required people to really talk to all of their constituents as opposed to just those on the left or those on the right, I think we would get a better mix of folks down there to really represent everyone as opposed to just one party over another.
As you look back on these 5 years you had in the House, do you have a sort of a singular accomplishment that you think of as your greatest accomplishment, the thing that makes you most proud to have served there?
I think there are a couple of things, actually. Something that was near and dear to my heart was food insecurity. And really, I believe I really raised the conversation around that issue. The last couple of years, I sponsored legislation that would create a new tax credit for the development of full-service grocery stores and food deserts, both in urban communities as well as rural communities. And a lot of folks, one, did not believe even in the word food desert and did not realize that actually the issue is even more pervasive in many of our rural counties and communities. And was at least, even though the legislation has not passed, was able to really shift the conversation around that. But sort of tied to that, one thing I was successful in doing was getting funding in the budget for urban agriculture. For a lot of kids in many of the urban communities, there was a disconnect between where food came from and sort of the process of getting food onto their plate. You know, they thought, oh, you just go to the grocery store and you get food, as opposed to really understanding what all goes into, the planting and the various steps in between to get food onto the plate. And I think for many of those kids that have been able to benefit from those grants, it opens up an idea of career opportunities that they may not have thought about otherwise also.
Do you feel like this is one of those issues where it was able to be seen in a nonpartisan way?
Yes. In getting that funding, I worked very closely with the Republican chairman of the Appropriations Committee to get that legislation or that funding into the budget. This is now the third year that we've had those grants that will be available. And so I had to work across the aisle. And the chairman of that committee also recognized the issue. And Missouri being a largely agricultural-based state, he recognized that this would be a benefit to everyone in the state. That was certainly one positive that I was able to accomplish.
So over these 5 years, do you feel like things have changed? Is the Missouri General Assembly a different place today than it was in 2013 when you first walked in the doors?
I think it certainly is. And unfortunately, I would say not for the good. Mm-hmm. I think over those last 5 years, it's become even more partisan. And particularly this last session, I think, was probably the most frustrating session that I've ever endured. And I think a large part of it had to do with Governor Greitens assuming the office, and with the Republicans having still supermajorities in both the House and the Senate, the for lack of better words, the arrogance of some members of the majority party just became it really exacerbated beyond where it had been in the past.
Can you give an example of that?
Filing and passing legislation that clearly had errors in it and still pushing it through, even though they knew that there were errors in the legislation. And then also, I'll give sort of one example. There was what seemed like a fairly innocuous bill of trying to celebrate the bicentennial history down in the Ozarks. There was a bill that was introduced, and it was named after a gentleman, Mr. Schoolcraft. And just a quick 30-second Google as they were presenting the bill on the floor, we recognized this gentleman was married to a woman who he encouraged to write a book which supported slavery and talked about slavery was a good thing for Africans because it helped tame these beastly people. And so I read an excerpt from the book on the floor, but they still were attempting to try to push this bill through, even recognizing whom it was named after. And it was only after, you know, kind of really continuing to press them on that and how ridiculous it was that they finally pulled the bill, and then they finally sort of did some amendments on a Senate version of the bill to have the gentleman's name taken out. But initially, they didn't want to. And it's that sort of arrogance that they would still try to push a bill that was recognizing a racist man, you know, just because they knew that they had the votes. That sort of arrogance just kind of boggled my mind.
You've had some criticism of the governor and of Republican leaders in the House and probably the Senate as well. I'm curious, especially now that you're sort of free to speak your mind since you're no longer part of the House, how do you think about how your own Democratic leadership either in the House and Senate have done or, you know, more broadly in the state party? Democrats in Missouri have not they're in a much weaker position today than they were 5 years ago when you first started in this. At least it appears that way. It certainly appears that way in terms of the offices they hold. What's the future hold for Democrats in Missouri? What in your view needs to change?
I think our numbers certainly have dwindled, but I think we are still strong. There were a number of bills and initiatives that did come up that we were able to either get amended so they weren't as egregious or to kill altogether. And I also just want to take a moment. I think Minority Floor Leader Gail McCann-Beatty has done a tremendous job, not only in helping to sort of bring together the 40, now 45 members of the Minority Caucus, but really creating a vision for us to move forward on and reaching out to potential candidates very early, as opposed to waiting until it's almost too late to start fielding candidates and really getting them prepared. I think she's done a tremendous job of working and moving us in that direction. And additionally, we have new leadership at the state party and former Representative Stephen Weber. And I think he also understands a lot of the needs of many of the communities who have felt that the Democratic Party has sort of turned their back on them, mm-hmm. particularly in many of the rural communities and some of the suburban communities that have turned Republican over the last couple of decades, and really beginning to have serious conversations with those folks to figure out what do we need to do as a Democratic Party to get them back on board. And so I think hearing from the people and earnestly listening to them and what their needs and concerns are, and then crafting our message around what those needs are, I think is one way for us to move forward and to get back to a point where we need to be to win back those seats.
You know, there was a really touching story that Representative McCann-Beatty told on the floor on the last day as the session was about to draw to a close. As you were being brought forward to the dais to sort of swing the gavel to close the session, there's some great pictures out there of that. But Gail McCann-Beatty told the story of how important you were in her actually being elected. How did that happen? What happened?
So I first met Representative Beatty in 2010. The district that I lived in at that time was represented by Roman LeBlanc, who decided not to run for re-election. And so I said, you know, why don't I file? And a little while after I filed, Representative Beatty filed. So I set up a meeting with her to talk with her, learn more about her and what her plans for the district were. And in that conversation, I felt very comfortable with her that she would be a strong leader for the district. And so I withdrew from the race and supported her, actually became her campaign treasurer. Huh. And campaigned very hard to ensure her victory in that race. So fast forward to 2 years later, I was with the redistricting drawn into a new district at that time, and I decided to run, and she returned the favor, and she campaigned very hard for me to ensure my victory as well. And since then, we've become very good friends and have continued to support each other since then.
That's a great story. I want to ask you about something else. You were one of three openly gay members of the Missouri General Assembly.
Yes.
I remember the first time there were stories about the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act. The first ones I remember reading that referred to openly gay members of the General Assembly. Your name wasn't on the list, even though you were already serving mm-hmm. at that time. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what it has been like serving the General Assembly as a gay man, and how that changed over the time you were there, and how you decided to come out to your colleagues in a more public way.
Well, I'll start by saying, like, I was never in the closet necessarily, but I was not as vocal in terms of my sexuality as I had been the last couple of years. And it was somewhat intentional because what I did not want to have happen for me is to be pigeonholed as, oh, that's the gay representative. I wanted to be, that's Representative Dunn who happens to be gay. But over the last couple of years, the rhetoric that I had been hearing from many of our colleagues towards the LGBT community just became worse and worse. And then we had the bathroom bills and the anti-trans bills. And I knew that I could not be as quiet as I would. And I was going to have to take a much more public stance on these issues than I had in the past.
And why? So, why did that mean you had to take a more public stance?
One, because there were so few of us who happened to be openly gay in the legislature. And then also for me, the intersectionality of not only being gay, but being African-American, and that being an added layer to the complexity of many of the issues of folks in the LGBT community, I felt that they needed to have a very vocal voice in the legislature. And so I decided to sort of take up that mantle and really be that voice for the people of color and the LGBT community. And I'm very glad that I did that. Again, this year, myself and Representative Greg Razor, who is also another openly LGBT representative from the Kansas City area, we both filed Mona, had a joint hearing on the bill, and we're working for next year to try to hopefully actually get it passed out of the House and hopefully sent to the governor's desk for his signing. You know, when it comes to it, it makes no sense that people can literally be fired and or evicted from their home because they're gay, or actually just because they're perceived to be gay. And it makes no sense. And so
the third openly gay member of the House is a Republican.
He is. Yes.
Has that changed things?
I'm hoping that it will. He spoke in support in committee of the Mona bill, which is really a very rare thing to do for someone who is not a sitting member on a committee to testify on behalf of legislation. And so for him to do that, I think, was certainly a very positive thing. And I'm hopeful that with him there and Representative Razor still being there, that these issues will remain at the forefront because these are real issues that impact people every day in their everyday lives. And it's something that really needs to be addressed.
It sounds like there's going to be a special session here soon. I don't know how you feel about the particulars of that session, but just the fact that your fellow legislators will be gathering again, the gavel will fall, there will be votes and debates. How will you feel about that when you know that they're in session, but you're not part of it anymore?
That part that I'm not a part of it doesn't necessarily bother me. What bothers me is the fact that the majority party could have passed all of these things during the regular session if they wanted to, as opposed to spending $125,000 a week to bring the legislators back for special sessions, again, for issues that they should have taken care of if they had their acts together during the regular session.
Although that's not so different from the governor's own argument. They should have taken care of this during the regular session. They didn't, so I'm going to cancel their vacations and make them come back to work and get the job done.
And I'll just say, I think that, to me, is very sophomoric of him to say. The legislature may not be in session during the summer, but people are not just off vacationing. People are back home in their districts, having town hall meetings, listening to their constituents. Constituent issues and concerns don't stop the day that session ends. And so for him to just call it a vacation that people have, I think is very disrespectful to the work that the legislature does outside of the regular legislative session. And again, I call it a failing on him. He's the governor. He should have been pushing his agenda to his party, who had the supermajority in the House and the Senate. He failed to do that. So I think that falls on his shoulder and not the shoulders of the legislature.
If you had a final word of wisdom for those who will come after you in the Missouri General Assembly, what would it be?
I'd say remember who sent you there and why they sent you there. It's not to enrich yourself. It's not to, do all these other things, but it's to be there to fight for the people and to advocate on behalf of the issues that are important to them. And I think if you always keep that in mind when you're taking votes and making decisions, then you really can't go wrong when you keep the people at the forefront of your mind.
Former Missouri Representative Randy Dunn, Democrat of Kansas City, now has resigned and has moved to Omaha for a community development job there. Randy, it is a great pleasure to talk with you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Great to have you here. Statehouse Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. Remember to subscribe to our podcast and also to review it. That's how people find out about us. You can even tell your friends in person, word of mouth. We're on iTunes and Google Play and on the NPR One app. We're also on Twitter. I'm at PTS Brian. If you care about Kansas, and we know you do, Statehouse Blend Kansas is hosted by my friend at Sam Zeff. Now that the session is over for now, we'll be taking a little time off this summer. We won't be here every week, but don't worry. We'll always be here when there's news or issues or special sessions to talk about in Jeff City. It's a great time to catch up on the archives of the podcast when we're not on the air. You can find them all and pictures of all of our guests at kcur.org. You can also send me an email, brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.